Ms. Johnson.
Good morning. Nastasia Johnson on behalf of plaintiff Ramona Jolivet. Your Honors, there are several reasons why the ALJ's decision finding Ms. Jolivet not disabled was improper in this case. First, it's undisputed by Judge Crabb and the Commissioner both agree that the ALJ failed to inform Ms. Jolivet of her statutory right to counsel at her hearing. So the issue before this Court is whether the ALJ erred by failing to qualify Ms. Jolivet's non-attorney representative, Mr. Taylor, and if Ms. Jolivet suffered prejudice from that failure.
So what is her best argument that she was prejudiced by her lack of legal representation by this very strange person who accompanied her?
The best argument would be that the ALJ specifically asked Mr. Taylor twice on the record at pages 360 and 361 for an argument as to why Ms. Jolivet was disabled. The ALJ was looking for instruction, looking for favorable evidence, and Mr. Taylor had none. As plaintiff argued, listing 1.04A was applicable in this case. Now, the ALJ did provide a one-paragraph analysis that does seem to parrot the requirements of 1.04A, but the ALJ did not talk about any of that favorable evidence. A qualified representative would have pointed out the favorable evidence to the ALJ and at least alerted the ALJ that the favorable evidence was there. As plaintiff argued in her opening brief, there was substantial evidence that Ms. Jolivet possibly met listing 1.04A in all its parts. The hallmark of 1.04A is nerve root compression. Tellingly, the ALJ held that Ms. Jolivet had no evidence of nerve root compression, but she was diagnosed with compression of the L5 nerve root. She was also diagnosed with spondylosis and myalgia parasthetica, which are both diagnoses having to do with nerve root compression. In addition, Mr. Taylor did not know the difference between being a representative and a witness. Periodically throughout the testimony, the ALJ had to remind him to either be a rep or a witness. If he was a representative, he could not testify on her behalf. He did not know what the vocational expert's role was. He kept questioning on who paid him and why did it matter, but the ALJ had to remind him that the vocational expert was an independent and neutral witness. And finally, the ALJ should have discussed, in the absence of a qualified representative, the ALJ should have discussed that favorable evidence that plaintiff pointed out in her opening brief that she met listing 1.04A. Because the ALJ only talked about the not favorable evidence instead of the evidence that demonstrated she could have met it, we just don't know if the ALJ either ever saw the evidence or if he did see it and ignored it. That goes back towards why a qualified representative would have pointed out that favorable evidence to the ALJ. In addition, the ALJ gave Dr. Porter, a neuropsychologist's opinion, little weight. Some of his findings were that Ms. Jolivet tested in the first percentile for fine motor manipulation and tested in the fourth percentile for speed and dexterity, had limits in comprehension and memory. Again, a qualified representative would have pointed this favorable evidence out to the ALJ and would have questioned the vocational expert on how Ms. Jolivet could return to her past relevant work as a bookkeeper with those limitations. The ALJ's discussion of why Dr. Porter was given little weight was based entirely on the fact that it was not based on objective medical findings and was contrary to the weight of the medical evidence. However, the Social Security regulations are clear that neuropsychological findings are objective medical evidence, and the ALJ also failed to identify any inconsistencies with Dr. Porter's findings with other medical evidence. The commissioner points to many factors as to why he believes that the ALJ rejected Dr. Porter's findings, but those were simply not discussed in the ALJ's decision. Finally, the ALJ's credibility determination was improper under 96.7P. The ALJ discussed some credibility factors, but under 96.7P, one of the important things is that the ALJ not place undue weight upon limited activities of daily living. In this case, she testified that she could do light driving, prepare some meals, and maintain concentration while watching television. This court has been clear that the ALJ must not place undue weight upon minimal activities of daily living. In addition, while the ALJ mentioned 3 of plaintiff's medications, she actually had taken 17 over the course of her treatment. This indicates a long-standing, persistent, and difficult-to-treat chronic pain syndrome that the ALJ should have at least discussed in his opinion and evaluated, and it should have been a factor that enhanced her credibility rather than detracted from it. If Your Honors have no further questions, I will save my remaining time for rebuttal.
Just out of curiosity, what is a book worker for a manure company?
I'm sorry? I couldn't quite hear you.
What on earth is a book worker for a manure company? I mean, she was injured driving a manure spreading truck.
Right.
Does a book worker drive the truck, or was she the bookkeeper driving the truck?
She was the bookkeeper. I think it was her husband's company, and she did multiple jobs for that company. One of them was as a bookkeeper.
Okay.
And at page 143 of the record, the vocational expert did prepare a statement in advance explaining what is involved with bookkeeping. And some of those things is repetitive motion of the hands because of typing. That goes again to Dr. Porter's findings that she tested in the first percentile for fine motor manipulation. A qualified rep would have alerted the ALJ to that finding and at minimum questioned the vocational expert on how she could return to that past relevant work with those findings. And finally, it's important to note that the ALJ seemed to accept some of Dr. Porter's findings that Ms. Jolovic could only stand and sit for 30 minutes continuously, but provided no explanation as to why he accepted part of the findings but rejected others. If Your Honors have no further questions, I'll reserve my time for rebuttal.
Certainly, Counsel. Mr. Kristoff.
May it please the Court, Edward Kristoff on behalf of Commissioner Astrew. The ALJ's decision in this case was reasonable. The ALJ fully and fairly developed the record, and its conclusions were supported by substantial evidence in that record. He reasonably weighed the medical evidence, and he articulated the reasons that he weighed the evidence as he did.
He certainly seemed to have ignored some of the evidence that would have favored Jolivet in analyzing listing 1.04A, and he ignored the evidence without giving any reason to do so. What do we do with that failure, especially, you know, in light of her lack of competent representation?
Well, with regard to listing 1.04A, Your Honor, the ALJ did not mention that he was evaluating her condition under listing 1.04A, and he only discussed some of the evidence in the record that was relevant to that listing. However, he did make a point-for-point analysis of some of the evidence under that listing, and ultimately, even if there was a deficiency in his articulation, Ms. Jolivet still hasn't come forward with the required evidence to show that she met the listing, so any error would be harmless. As we discussed at some length in our briefs, she had to show that she had positive signs on straight leg raising tests. And in her main brief, Ms. Jolivet argued that there were 7 instances in this record that showed positive straight leg raise testing. We pointed out that there seemed to be misunderstanding as to what a positive straight leg raising test was, and in a reply, she concedes that 5 of those 7 were not in fact positive, but she still claims that there are 2. And if we look at those 2, she points to one of them and says that it came from Dr. Yang, who's at the spine clinic at the Mayo Clinic, and certainly he knows what a positive straight leg raising test looks like. Unfortunately, the evidence that she cites in support of that argument doesn't come from Dr. Yang. It comes from a physical therapist. And in fact, even that report from the physical therapist does not document a positive straight leg raising test. Instead, it shows the amount of flexibility she had when he tested her straight leg raising. It says nothing about a neurological sign.
You know, the ALJ seems to have found that she was exaggerating her symptoms in part because surgery was never indicated for her condition. But any number of serious conditions are inoperable for reasons that are totally unrelated to how much pain or how much impairment they cause. It looked like this was an ALJ playing doctor and making unwarranted assumptions. And, you know, in the same vein, both the ALJ and the district court seem to have decided that her depression and anxiety weren't serious because she wasn't receiving treatment. But we have evidence that she stopped taking her Paxil because she couldn't afford it. Presumably, if she can't afford Paxil, she can't afford a psychiatrist or some other treatment. I mean, what kind of reasons are these to discount her credibility? I mean, it just looks like a lot of speculation and discounting the economic realities for an unemployed person.
Your Honor, addressing the issue of surgery, the ALJ is required under the regulations to consider the nature and extent of the treatment that the claimant receives. That she did not have surgery is certainly important evidence in making that evaluation. Now, the ALJ didn't hang this decision on whether or not she had back surgery, but he was required to consider that as a factor. As to the mental limitations in this case, I would note that the mental limitations appear nowhere in plaintiff's argument before this court. She's not alleging disability on the basis of any mental limitations. And even Dr. Porter,
depression and anxiety is part of her argument, isn't it?
But Your Honor, she's arguing her physical limitations. She's arguing that Dr. Porter's report should have been accepted in this case. And even Dr. Porter, who performed the vocational evaluation, noted that she was doing well on the Paxil. So,
but she couldn't afford the Paxil.
For a time, and then she went back on the Paxil. And as the appellant argued when she got up here, she was on 17 medications at various times. She was able to afford medication when she needed it. She was off Paxil for a while, and then she got back on.
Well, we don't know if those were samples. The record doesn't tell us, if some of them were over-the-counter, aspirin, that sort of thing.
Your Honor, I'm not in a position to speculate as to what types of medication she was getting under what circumstances.
But you are speculating by saying she could afford 17 different medications. That is speculation.
If I misspoke and said that she could afford them, then I apologize. She was taking 17 medications, and that's not disputed on the record. But getting back to the straight leg raising, which is a required element of listing 1.04A, we have the report of the physical therapist, which did not show positive straight leg raising, but then we do have the one instance in this record where she had a positive straight leg raising test, and that came from Dr. Downey. Now, Dr. Downey had seen her several times before and had not found sciatica or other sign of neurological problems, and then he made what he said was a new finding. He found sciatica on straight leg raising. And then he saw her twice after that, and he specifically noted there was no sciatica. And so this was not a persistent finding. And subsequent evaluations from other medical sources also didn't find sciatica. We have at least 11 mentions in the record of a medical source evaluating her for straight leg raising, and only one time, this report from Dr. Downey, where she found to have a positive straight leg raising test. And under the regulations, one instance in a approximately three-year period is not enough to establish the finding required to show that she met listing 1.04A. And without that, regardless of any error the ALJ made at 8 in articulating 1.04A, it's a harmless error. She can't show that she satisfied the listing, and she had to meet that burden. With regard to Dr. Porter's opinion, Dr. Porter was not a treating physician. He saw her on two occasions to perform a vocational rehabilitation examination. Dr. Porter found that she had problems with manipulation. No doctor in this record has ever pointed to a physical condition of any kind that could cause a problem with manipulation. Ms. Jolivet can't be found to be disabled without the presence of a medically determinable impairment that could cause that disability. Dr. Porter didn't identify an impairment that would have caused those limitations in her manipulation. Therefore, the ALJ was not obligated to incorporate those manipulation limitations into his RFC finding in the case. As we also point out in our brief, and as plaintiff concedes in her reply, Dr. Porter relied on a complete misstatement of Dr. Alexander's opinion in coming up with his assessment of her ability to work. Since his opinion relies on a misstatement, it was appropriate for the ALJ to give his opinion little weight. Dr. Porter opined that she could only work 2 to 4 hours a day. He provided no explanation for limiting her to 2 to 4 hours a day. There was no indication in his report that she had problems with fatigue or anything else that would explain why he thought she could only work part-time. It was entirely reasonable for the ALJ to accord his opinion little weight.
The strangest part of this case is the non-attorney representative. Because, you know, once he starts talking, it becomes clear immediately that he has no idea what he's doing there. Wouldn't the ALJ have been the best person at that point to determine whether he was qualified? And even if it's not the ALJ's burden to evaluate the non-attorney representative before proceedings begin, shouldn't it be the ALJ's job to address qualifications when serious questions arise?
Well, Your Honor, the regulations anticipate that there are four factors on which qualification will be considered for a non-attorney.
Yeah.
And only one of them seems to be relevant in this case, and that is whether he was able to provide valuable assistance. And the regulation doesn't go beyond that in explaining what valuable assistance is. Although Ms. Jolivet denied it at the hearing, it seems pretty clear that the two of them had a prior relationship. Mr. Taylor talked about having purchased her a walker at some point, which she did not use. And therefore, when we're talking about valuable assistance, I think it's important to go beyond just what an attorney would have done under the circumstance, but what's the relationship there? Was he the best person able to make her feel comfortable at the hearing, to talk about the things that she wanted to talk about? He provided value in that he asked her questions. He questioned the vocational expert. He provided a closing argument. He was not completely valueless to her at this hearing. And the ALJ did not act unreasonably in denying Ms. Jolivet the opportunity to be represented by the person that she chose. But in any case, the key point is that the ALJ fully and fairly developed the record, regardless of the nature of her representation. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you, Counsel. Anything further, Ms. Johnson?
Just to address the Commissioner's last point, 1705B does require that a non-attorney rep be able to give qualified help. That has nothing to do with how well they know that person or how if they have a relationship that exists outside of the hearing. It has to do with how well that they are familiar with the procedures of hearings, can familiar with the record before the ALJ, able to point out that favorable evidence and point to the listings that have to do with the claimant's impairments. In this case, for back impairment, an obvious listing would have been 1.04A. As I previously discussed, he did not talk about that whatsoever.
But our legal standard for purposes of deciding whether there was reversible error or not doesn't focus on whether he was or wasn't qualified and rendered adequate assistance. The question is whether the ALJ developed the record adequately in order to decide the case. So all of the focus on what a qualified representative would have done is sort of beside the point.
Your Honor,
the standard that we're applying is whether the ALJ did what he was supposed to do to develop the record in order to decide the case.
Right. But the point is that the ALJ failed to even talk about those favorable findings in his decision.
That's a different question. That focuses on whether the ALJ's explanation for his decision was adequate and supported by the evidence, which is a different sort of an inquiry.
Well,
looking at the record and what the ALJ did to draw out the petitioner here in order to give her an opportunity to present her claim, it seems to me, was perfectly adequate.
Well, one specific example I can give to you on that point is that Dr. Porter's findings are based on her fine motor manipulation, speed and dexterity, and ability to comprehend and memorize. The ALJ never asked a question on that point. So as far as fully and fairly developing the record and specific examples, that would be one that would cause the ALJ's failure to develop the record to be not harmless error. In addition, as far as what the commissioner was saying about the positive straight leg raising test, the fact is there is no requirement that there is a frequency or consistent, persistent findings. The fact is there was evidence in the record that the ALJ either did not see or chose to ignore. And just because a candidate is not a surgical candidate, just because a claimant is not a surgical candidate, does not mean that they are not in disabling pain. If Your Honors have no further questions, we respectfully ask this Court to reverse the decision of the ALJ and remand for further proceedings. Thank you.
Thank you very much. The case is taken under advisement.